All right, Christopher here. Welcome to Do Explain. Before we begin, I'd like to thank my current supporters who inspire me to carry on with this project and make it financially viable as well. I'm very grateful to all of you. Big hugs. And while I'm not in the business of telling people what to do, I can share my vision for Do Explain going forward. I like to work on the podcast full-time instead of just a few days a month. I want to build a real platform for the fun and friendly exchange of interesting ideas, and I want to do it ad-free, if possible, because I don't want any ideas to be off-limits for us to explore, and I also want to keep saying dumb shit without repercussions. But to do this, I'll need a steady income, and that's why I need your help. So if you enjoy what I'm doing here, and you want to join me in my vision and become a part of growing this project, consider going over to patreon.com/doexplain and sign up to become a monthly supporter. All right, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. All right, so this is the first episode of 2023, and I'm glad to be back with my dear friend and fellow consciousness explorer, Jake Orthwine. How are you doing, sir?
I'm excellent, man. I'm thrilled to be here. Glad to be back. Been too long.
Yes, it definitely has been. And like we were saying before we started recording, Jake, because of the time difference here, Jake starts off pretty groggy and then he gets more and more caffeinated, whereas I start tired and I just progressively become more so. We think it's a good combination. We'll see.
The middle of the conversation will be perfect. It will be we'll be both firing on all cylinders. And then I will become crazy and you will become sleepy.
Yeah, I guess that's why they call it the middle way. That's where that originates from, right?
Exactly. It's a meta lesson of our subject matter today.
Yes. So, yes, I'm going to jump straight in here. We usually have tons to talk about. And today we want to center the discussion around a traditionally Buddhist concept called emptiness. And that word sounds like a bummer, and we'll get into why that's not the case and why it's actually something very beautiful and liberative in the end, understood and experienced correctly. Mm-hmm. And my purpose with the discussion is basically to try to attack this concept from as many different angles as possible. And see if we can clear up both some conceptual confusion that I surely have and probably many people listening to this will have, and also to see if we can give some useful pointers towards the experience and the practice side as well. Yeah, I think that's enough of a prelude. So what do you think of that? Does that sound good to you?
Yeah. That all sounds great. As is customary with these things, I should especially because we're talking about pretty kind of in-depth meditative ideas and things. I should flag that I am not qualified to do so in any important sense. And especially with this subject, I've been listening a bunch, both just for my own edification and somewhat in preparation for this conversation. I've been listening to a bunch of Robert Bea talks. Robert Bea is a meditation teacher who passed away a couple of years ago, who's probably just the most interesting person to listen to on this particular topic. But one of the things that I became acutely aware of in listening to him is how sensitive he is to all the various kinds of misunderstandings that can develop in talking about this topic. We just won't have time to be that kind of sensitive about it. But there are various, especially if you're practicing or considering whether you ought to practice meditation or with this material. There's a lot of nuance that can be gotten into, and I'm not sort of not equipped to sort of protect everybody against all the pitfalls there. So I just want to flag that I don't really know what I'm talking about, and that you and I will be approaching this as a mutual exploration of a mutually interesting topic and not much more. But yes, I'm very eager to have the conversation with you.
Yeah. No, I think that's great that you do that. Maybe we can just extract that from this episode and we can just have like a prelude that I play generically in front of every episode we do.
I think we can have you saying, you know, enlightened meditation master Jake Orthwein gives us deep insight into emptiness, and I will lose my mind. We should also probably say this is you'll have it labeled this way, but though it is a major subject matter in a certain way of the David Chapman material, we're not really going to be talking about this as part of our sort of Chapman series. So this is not the David Chapman take on emptiness. We'll probably get into it to some extent. But this is just sort of apart from that. You and I are going to talk about emptiness and leave aside somewhat how Chapman applies that concept.
Yes. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So there are a lot of different angles one can tackle this and start from. So I guess what we could
Should
do
we start
is...
with what the hell is emptiness?
Yeah, that's as good a formulation as any. So, what the hell is emptiness, Jake? And we'll take it from there.
Okay, cool. So in the Buddhist tradition and to some extent in other strands of Eastern religion and philosophy, there's this preoccupation with the question of whether things have independent existence, which is not to say is not quite the same as whether they exist. And we'll get into sort of how that is a common misunderstanding. But whether they have independent existence, there's this term, I think in Sanskrit of svabhava, which means own being, or like whether they're self-standing. Emptiness is essentially the claim that things lack independent existence. Empty of what? Empty of this inherent independent existence or self nature. Another piece here that I'm sure we'll get into is this idea of no self that shows up in Buddhism. The self, as it's discussed in Buddhism, really is just this essence or independent existence as applied to the person. And so you'll even hear the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena talked about in Buddhism. You know, for that to make any sense, you have to have this idea that, you know, okay, what does it mean for phenomena like, you know, tables and chairs and other appearances in awareness to lack a self? It is this idea of emptiness being discussed there, where it's like things lack the thing in virtue of which they are themselves. Or an essence, or an independent existence, and we can get into why that's not just a like totally useless, strange philosophical nicety. But that's the basic idea of emptiness, that things lack independent existence. And then there are two other ways of talking about it that start to get into why it's significant and liberating in a Buddhist context. And one is that emptiness means a mere construction of mind, and that's a framing that you'll sometimes get in the mind only or Chittamatra school of Buddhism. And then the one that Rob Berbea, whom we mentioned briefly, uses that runs very, very deep. And I think it's a very productive one from the standpoint of a practitioner is emptiness means dependent on the way of looking. And you can see how this idea of lacking independent or inherent existence and being dependent on the way of looking go together, because there's no particular way it is separate from the way it's looked at, and that means it lacks inherent existence. It's not a particular way on its own. But okay, that's broadly what emptiness is. Nice. don't be alarmed if you have no idea why that would be interesting or important at this point.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, because I know my brother is going to probably shrug his shoulders at that. But so is there any reason for us right now to differentiate between making claims about metaphysics, such as, you know, objects being empty, and solely limiting the discussion to subjective experience? Is there a reason to do that? Or how do you think about that?
I think you can just leave metaphysics altogether to one side and just have no take on metaphysics. You know, in some contexts, Buddhism will be expressly talked about as anti-metaphysical in this sense of just like, you just don't know what's the case about metaphysics, and you could just bracket it and leave it to one side. But you did mention objects, and there, this actually relates to our previous conversations. you know, I tend to put objectness under the banner of ontology. And some people use ontology and metaphysics interchangeably, where they're both about whatever's out there in the world in a final sense. And I tend to say metaphysics is whatever's out there in the world in some final sense. But ontology, how things are parsed into objects and categories and things like that, that to me has to do with us as persons. And that gets to this idea of emptiness, which is, yeah, I think emptiness has everything to do with ontology in some sense, but nothing really to do with metaphysics. And then, yeah, to your point, from a meditative point of view, in the Buddhist tradition, you'll see it, you know, that qualification doesn't often get made. And there's a mix of people who are sort of constructing a philosophy of emptiness to explain meditative experience, and people who are sort of just engaging it scholastically and everything in between. And yeah, so, right. But yeah, I think the most productive, I think, way of engaging it, as you say, is as an inquiry about experience and things as they appear in experience, which includes objects and even the world as it appears in experience, without having to say anything final about what the world is like. Yeah. So I think that's the way to engage it.
Yeah. The mind is your only problem. Yeah. Framing. I like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mentioned Chittamatra or mind only. That is interesting. We may not want to get into this cause it's just like a little bit too esoteric, but yeah, that framing is kind of it's like a way station on the way. Like it's not actually that's a sort of provisional claim that you would make as a practice rather than some final statement that they're making about the nature of reality, because you can undertake as a practice to start regarding everything that arises in experience as in the mind and created by mind. And that includes the apparently sort of external world, right? And the reason why you would do this is that the sort of habit, the kind of implicit conceptual habit of attributing out there-ness to the phenomena of the world, it's a kind of mistaking things for having independent existence in the sense of it reifying the distinction between inside and outside and between self and world and all these things. And so it's a way of sort of relaxing that habit. You can train yourself as a matter of view to say this is all in the mind and created by mind, and that there's no difference in substance between things that arise and you attribute them to be like interior and things that arise and you attribute them to be exterior. That's essentially a conceptual distinction that you're making on a field of experience that lacks that distinction. And the reason why I say it's not the final thing is that to say it's all mind would be over reifying one side of that mind world duality in some sense. So from the hard duality of there's the mind and then there's the world and both are independently existing, making it all one thing is a helpful way station, but then you don't want to develop this sort of like God complex of I'm generating the world either, because that wouldn't quite right. Anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's important. And it kind of ties into, I think it's important for us to frame why the fuck somebody should care about it as well. Why is this important and not just some highfalutin philosophizing, right? And to stress once again that it's the concept of emptiness and, what's called the view from certain traditions such as Dzogchen that we've spoken about before. The point of that is to point to something that's already true of everybody's conscious experience, whether they know it or not. So the cash value is actually in the experience, not just the philosophizing, although philosophizing can be extremely useful. So why should we care about emptiness? Why should we sit through this conversation if we don't already know?
Well, yeah, just really quick, I'm going to make a very, very nitpicky distinction in terms of please. You said the cash value is in the experience. And to some extent, that's true in the sense that like you can't just embrace it conceptually and have it work the way it's intended to. But I would actually say that the cash value is in some sense in the understanding, which depends on having had, generally speaking, repeated experience. But it's not that you sort of have this dramatic experience of emptiness, as is often gets talked about, and then you're good. It's much better. It's much more because and so it's much more a matter of having that understanding develop over time than it is about particular experiences. But okay, so why care about emptiness? So the somewhat radical, not somewhat, that the in fact radical claim of the Buddhist tradition is that the misimpression, this sort of mistake of taking phenomena to have inherent or independent existence, is the cause of suffering, and that without seeing that, without understanding that, without developing deep insight into that fact, we will suffer. And so it's not at all obvious, even to most meditators, that that's the case, that we suffer because we take phenomena to have an inherent existence. But that's the reason why it's significant and interesting and important, is that ignorance, that misimpression of taking phenomena at various kinds of like subtle levels to have inherent or independent existence is the root of suffering. And to give somebody like a very concrete sense of how that could be the case, imagine that you're sort of wrapped up in like a temper tantrum, right? And to be wrapped up in the temper tantrum is to have a bunch of things going all at once. You've got a story that you're telling yourself, very likely about, you know, all the reasons why you have every right to be mad. You've got all these emotions coming up in your body that are really intense and seem to have this sort of like imperative to act associated with them. And none of that really, from your point of view, all of it is being taken extremely seriously to mean exactly what it seems to mean. And if you had some mindfulness to sort of bring to bear in that situation, you might undertake as a sort of inquiry, okay, like here, just to break it down by parts, here's the subset of this temper tantrum that is, you know, the anger coming up in my body. Okay, so you've called it anger. Here's these sensations that are coming up in your body. And it seems to be anger, and therefore it seems to have this sort of intrinsically, I mean, different people feel different ways about anger. You could feel positive about anger, but it seems to have this sort of self-standing quality as being anger. And then if it's just anger, well, the idea that you would then be angry and sort of act it out almost seems inevitable. Like there's a midway move where you can be aware of it as anger, but it's still anger and it's still sort of aversive and unpleasant. Mm-hmm. But if you were to sort of take this emptiness framing on as a practice, you could start investigating, okay, how do I know that this is anger? And you would start looking for, okay, with your awareness, searching through the sensation, in virtue of what is this anger? Is it that little tingle in my chest that makes it anger? Is that like intrinsically anger? And then keep looking. And something very strange happens if you start doing that, which is that the more you sort of search with your awareness through the sensations that constitute the anger, the less obvious it is what it is at all. And ultimately, a sort of, especially with a particular way of practicing, it resolves as unfindable. Which is not, in a very strange paradoxical sense, it's not quite the same thing as saying it doesn't appear, but you can't find anything in itself with your awareness that is that anger. And then if that works, it's not anger anymore in any sort of definite sense. And you start, if you sort of repeat those kinds of insights over and over and over again. And by the way, I should say all of this is true, not just of the sensations, but of the story you were telling yourself and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And if you repeat that insight over and over again, you start to get a sense of the way you are participating, or the you know, to go back to this definition of dependence on the way of looking, the way of looking at the sensation, the sort of stance you take toward it, is participating in building the sensation as what it is or what it seems to be. And if that's the case, this radical kind of freedom opens up to build it a different way, or to not build it at all, or you know, to have more degrees of freedom relative to the anger, and for it to no longer be anger, you know, for it to just be energy, or even for the energy to, you know, like, it sort of goes all the way down essentially to however it appears. There's no sort of the sort of extreme claim would be that there's no experience that that doesn't depend on a way of looking. So everything, it's not that it seems to be anger, but really it's just energy. The energy is also dependent on the way of looking, and so on all the way down. And the deeper that insight penetrates, the more freedom there is, both to sort of not be bound by a particular interpretation or fixed meanings, would be the sort of Chapman way of putting it, but also to skillfully construct different meanings in any given context. So that's why it's significant and interesting.
So how I can see people hearing that for the first time and then interpreting you to say that it basically is all relative, or it, you know, you can construct whatever you want, or everything is just, you know, how do we pertain the importance of to use Chapman's terminology, pattern, and the fact that even if something such as whatever we call anger, that experience, there is something that concept is trying to get at, whether we can find the essence of it or not. And so that experience is very different from the experience of what I call sadness or happiness or the urge to urinate or whatever. And so, yeah, so how can we retain the differentiation and still discover the freedom that you're talking about and not be bound in the same way by the deadness of the concepts that we plaster on the experience?
Yeah. Okay. Well, so there are two kind of questions in there. One is, why is emptiness not monism? And this is to your question about like differentiation, like why is happiness not sadness, not, you know, music, you know, like all the way down to all the differentiated ways that experience appears, right? So that's one question. And emptiness certainly isn't that. It's not the denial of distinctions between different experiences. But to let me start with your other question, which is like, okay, why doesn't this devolve into a sort of nihilistic kind of relativism or an idealism, like everything is just up to you and you can just construct experience however you want? So it's tricky to understand this, but say that were the case, say it were just an idealism, that would be positing a certain kind of independent existence in the language of you know, Buddhism or whatever. So if it were the case that, to go back to our earlier point about, you know, in the mind created by mind, if I'm just generating all of this at a whim, then I'm giving a certain sort of self-standing quality to the mind and to the way of looking, to the mind, that I've said, okay, it's not in the world, but it is in my mind. You know, I can just make things however I want to. And that's sort of reifying the other side of the distinction. So the claim is not that it's, you know, everything just is the mind, which has independent existence. The claim is that nothing that appears has independent existence of the way of looking, which is not to say that the other side of that divide, rather than the thing, but the way of looking, has independent existence. And so it's sort of, it's, you know, there's this concept in Buddhism of dependent origination, which is that, again, it's sort of the other side of the coin of emptiness, where things don't have independent existence. What kind of existence do they have? They dependently arise on conditions coming together. And so it's not that some conditions really do have independent existence and others don't. It's that conditions have to come together for things to arise. But that's a very Buddhist way of putting it. To take concretely something like anger, you're not infinitely free to sort of generate it however you like, although there's more and more degrees of freedom, the more sort of deeply the understanding of emptiness penetrates. But there's again, if it's total, I mean, okay, so take a sort of extreme example. of, or not even an extreme example, but a very simple example of like countries. So forget about anger for a minute. Okay. It's clear, or it should be clear to people, that to some extent, where the borders between countries are attributed is dependent on conceptual imputation, or like dependent on us. You're right. Like the boundary between the United States and Mexico is not inscribed in the land objectively somehow, right? Like we are in some sense imputing that boundary and then acting as though it exists in various ways and comporting ourselves in various ways toward that boundary. But it's not there out there in the land. Okay. So In that sense, we are creating that boundary. We're not creating everything about that condition, right? Like there is land there. There's a very, 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 very sort of facts about the terrain, and it's in relationship to that, you could say, objective reality that our socially constructed sort of imposition of borders is in dialogue. Okay, so that's somewhere in between. It's not quite totally objective and not quite totally subjective either, in the sense that it has to be in relationship to the actual pattern that's there. Okay, so that's like an example of this neither totally subjective nor totally objective thing.
So you could say, just to add to that, so you could say that the difference between standing naked on Antarctica or in California is going to be very different in terms of you can be in Antarctica and be naked there, and you can see the emptiness of whatever you would call freezing cold. But you don't have unlimited power to then reconstruct that as comfortable heat or as unproblematic when a polar bear comes to chew your head off.
Yeah, I think that's right. It is right. It is so that there's this confusing thing about it does in some sense run all the way down, where you never hit something that like this is just a given, like for example, like as a polar bear or something like that. But and so it can become somewhat confusing to say emptiness runs all the way down, and also to say, you know, it's not mere relativism, it is a kind of relativism, but it's not a not a nihilistic kind.
You mean it's for a polar bear to be a polar bear, it has to like it's a problem for me because of the type of organism I am, and the danger of the polar bear arises codependently as a relationship between the two of us.
Yeah, to go back to your emphasis on experience, the experience of the polar bear, however it shows up, the vision of the polar bear, the sound of the polar bear, et cetera, all of those things, all of those aspects of your perception of it, including your concept about it, but all of those things in any given moment, you will be fabricating, to use a sort of Bourbeau term, you will be generating in some sense, and you won't be generating it as a separately existing thing. It's in some sense you and the world that are both generating it, but the way it appears will depend on the way of looking. And you know, in the extreme case, and this is where you get in Theravada Buddhism, you know, this idea of cessation, or like, you know, sort of dropping out of experience altogether if you take a certain practice far enough. In the extreme case, that anything appears at all depends on clinging, or like depends on a particular way of looking. So there's no appearance without the particular way of looking, and that's what it means to say emptiness runs all the way down. It's not really about an objective claim about what's out there. Is there a polar bear out there or not? It's a claim about how things appear, including time and space and world and everything like that, will always be dependent on the way of looking.
I mean, I feel like the critical rationalists in the audience will be kind of excited about that there's no, there's always a frame of reference. There's perception is theory laden to a really, really deep degree.
Well, I think some will be excited and some will be angry depending on which part of this they're emphasizing. If you emphasize in some important sense, this is the same as or analogous to the claim about deep theory ladenness of that. There's no There's no perception in the absence of theory. There's no direct experience. There's no immediate experience, unmediated experience. So that, yeah, that's exactly right that there's an analogy there. You know, the other side of that coin that they may be less happy with is the there's no access to the way things are with a capital A, even by conjecture, you know.
Right. I mean, but okay, so I want to lift it out of the Buddhist context for a little bit and just, I'm not sure what I think about the idea of, you know, the Bayesian brain, and I still have all the epistemological alarm bells go off when I hear the priors and the probabilities and updating and all that stuff. But yeah. There's a really interesting talk out there by, I think his name is Shamil something. I don't know if you
Shamil
know his last name.
The most interesting man in the world.
He seems exceptionally interesting. Yes, but no, he's very interesting, and he has this talk. I think it's called the Bayesian brain and meditation, or something along those lines. And it's an attempt to frame these type of insights that are most explored traditionally within a Buddhist or Hindu or those type of contexts, classically religious context, right? And to put it into a secular scientific worldview, to have a theory of non-dual empty awareness or whatever. And so in very, very broad and clumsy terms, the way I understand that theory is basically that, because you said in the beginning here, you said that nothing has self-existence, and you know it's all in terms of experience, you can think of it as all mind, and that can be hard to grasp what that means in a secular context. But it's basically the idea that your brain is generating a generative model. So it's co-constructing whatever is coming in through the sense apparatus that you have as a human being. And you come with all these prior theories, priors, and then you predict, if this is true, if the theories I have are true, what would I expect to see in terms of input from the world? And then you get a prediction error there where the world actually differs from what you think you're supposed to see, and then you update your generative model, i.e. the virtual reality simulation that you're running, which is basically everything you experience, and that includes your conception of the feeling of having a body in the world, and then the world who's seemingly outside of that body, outside of you, and then internal to the body is this self-representation that we've attacked or criticized in different episodes. And the claim is basically that all of this is happening inside of your generative model. This is the generative model, and there's no difference between, I'm looking out of my window now, there's no difference between what I sense to be, I don't know, an internal sense of indigestion right now in my stomach, and the car that I see out there, presumably on the street. All of this is happening within my model. And so in this sense, could be said to be just as much me as the sensation of indigestion in my stomach. And once again, it's not supposed to make the claim that I as an organism doesn't exist and am separate from whatever is being constructed codependently as the car in the world. But it's a quite profound way to think about it. Yeah, think about that fact, I guess. I just like that way of framing it, because you can get there without any of the religious claims, or even for people who think that just mentioning Buddhism makes them stop listening to it. It's just cool to think about it in that frame, I think.
I suspect in your audience, mentioning Bayesianism will go over worse than mentioning
Buddhism. Yeah, possibly. That's true.
That was it. That was a beautiful description. I'm not sure how much I can add to it, but yeah. Okay. So Shamil Chandaria is both a very, very, very interesting guy with a very interesting background. He sort of was a financier and then reskilled in neuroscience and has a background in math, and is also a very, very serious meditator, was a student of Robert Baez, whom we mentioned. and has sort of been working both as a funder and as a person conducting a bunch of this interesting research on neuroscience and psychedelics and meditation. And so what you just described is his account of what's going on in meditation through the lens of what's called predictive processing, which is a sort of overarching theory about how the mind computes, or brains compute. And that the basic picture, and just to fill in some of what you said, is that there's essentially the brain is a kind of prediction engine, and it's a hierarchical prediction engine. So you can imagine just sort of abstractly, like neurons layered in a sort of hierarchy, where the lowest level might be like the sensory input that you're getting. And at each step of the, at each sort of layer of the hierarchy, the stuff that's being fed up from the lower level is being compared to a prediction about what's going to be fed up from the lower level. And then the results of that comparison, the prediction error, gets passed up to the higher level to adjust it. And so on and so on and so on, all the way up the hierarchy, right? So what you experience in any given moment is, on this account, the result of what you are predicting you will experience as updated at the margins by the prediction error. In the first case, you know, fed up from sensory data, but then, you know, what gets passed up is not directly sensory data, but the prediction error from the lower level of the hierarchy, right? So... yeah. That's broadly how it works. And as you say, yeah, it's you're experiencing the generative model, but it's not the generative. It's not. So there's this phrase, you know, from Anil Seth, who also works in this field, and you know, he'll say consciousness is a controlled hallucination, and you can say that the controlled part is the why it's not independently existing on this view. You know, it's right. It's controlled by the prediction. By the prediction error, by the comparison with what gets fed up from the lower levels, which ultimately grounds out in sensory data. But it's not just the raw sensory data, you know, as the crit rats will say, you know, it's there's no experience of sensory data, you know, absent an interpretation, or in this case, absent a generative model that is being compared with that data. So yeah, what you experience is the model. So that gets to this idea of, you know, in the mind, created by mind. It's empty in the sense of there's no, okay, well, let me start fill in some of why this model would explain interesting aspects of meditative experience. So if you pay very, very close attention to sensations, as one often does in meditation, what that corresponds to, and it's very difficult to get a sense of this without seeing some of Shamil's visuals, but you know, we'll do the best we can. What that corresponds to in this model is increasing what's called the precision weighting on lower level sensory data. And the precision weighting roughly corresponds to like the kind of confidence not in a sort of felt sense of confidence, but in a, you know, overall sense of how the system functions. It corresponds to the confidence one has in those signals. And so if you increase by paying greater attention to this sort of raw sensations, you increase the precision weighting, that increases the capacity of those lower level sensations to update the model held in the higher level concept. So we can think about it as like at the low level, sensations are just, you can get a sense of this by paying attention to your hand. They're just this sort of like tingling, right? And over time, those sensations contribute to the generation of a model at a higher level of like, okay, there's a hand there, right? And like, you know, the shape of a hand. But the lower level sensations never actually, you know, are like the higher level, much more abstract conception of there's a hand there. And you can get this sort of what's called reification, or sort of like fixation of the higher level model of like handness, that then in some sense like gets stuck and is no longer sort of like responsive to what's actually going on, which is something much more nebulous than this, you know, essence of hand. And so by increasing the precision weighting on the lower level sensations, the higher level model of like a hand there gets de-reified into something much more like a process and much less like a thing. And this sort of happens all the way up the hierarchy until at the top of the hierarchy, or at the center, depending on how you shape it, is this sense of the self as a particular thing. Because again, the way this whole predictive processing framework is set up is that you're doing all of this cognition and prediction in the service of the maintenance of your sort of embodiment as an organism, right? So you can in some sense the central prediction that you're trying to sustain is your own continued existence, and
right.
So you can see how paying attention to these low level sensations, which would update the higher level models to become more like processes and less like objects, and so on and so on and so on all the way up, would ultimately start to impact the sense of the self as some solid, self-standing, independently existing thing. And this is very central to Buddhism, is both the emptiness of phenomena and then crucially the emptiness of the self, of the person.
I really like Michael Taft's way of explaining this. He said, I'm currently enrolled in the Vast Sky Mind course, which is, I think it's the tagline, a course on non-dual meditation and awakening or something like that. And really enjoying it. And I, in the first Zoom lecture that he held, he went through the idea that, yeah, we're living through this veil of conceptualization, which is like the higher level concepts that you were talking about there. And it's a very useful capacity to have. I mean, in some sense, it's very useful for me to be able to abstract away and say, this is my whole body when I'm supposed to move, or even this is my hand. This is me as opposed to you in my experience. All of this is useful. And I think that's important to stress, that that's not, we don't want to get away from the capacity to do this and basically become, it's not just melting into this undifferentiated goo where you're not capable of going to the bathroom by yourself. Like that's not the end goal. And
yeah.
But so what he said there that I resonated a lot with was the idea that when these concepts, this higher level concept gets too reified, and you start to think that the concept itself is more real than the actual experience that you're having, and it deadens the experience, because whenever you've abstracted something, let's use a person as an example. Whenever I've said that, okay, this is who Jake is. I mean, it's good to have that model to be able to predict and have certain patterns of and know what I should expect from you to some extent. But the second I do that and I say, this idea that I have, this higher level concept of who Jake is, now I've put you in a box. And the second I've done that, you've already escaped the box. Because as we've said, you don't have any fundamental essence that can be boxed in. You're in constant movement and you're in a dance with me and everything around you and constantly changing. And so if you don't see this, you will be living to some extent in a dead world, which when said that way, I thought was very hard-hitting for me and quite intriguing, I thought as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a beautiful way of putting it. I think also, and there's a probably the best explanation of emptiness that I am aware of in one place is this talk by this Dzogchen teacher, James Lowe.
James Lowe, yeah.
Called Why Emptiness is Liberating. And yeah, he gives a very similar explanation that I love. Let me see. What could I add to that? That was well put. Well, okay, yeah. So to get maybe to your point about why this isn't about getting rid of concepts, this can be very difficult to understand, both experientially and conceptually. Like, why, for example,
and get rid of yourself? Because I want
to. Yeah, yeah. So, well, okay. So this,
like, the fear of emptiness kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's. Well, okay, there are two different directions you can take this. Let's start with this idea of the self. So remember how I said at the beginning that sometimes you'll see this description of both the selflessness of the person and the selflessness of phenomena in Buddhism, right? And that starts to point to how they're using this term self in a different way than we tend to use it in English and in the West, which we tend to use the term self to refer to the whole person or to various aspects of the person or of the personality or anything like that, right? And but in that sense, it doesn't really make sense what it would mean to say the selflessness of phenomena. Like, why is that significant, right? Like, why does it matter that, you know, cups don't have selves or something like that, right? And the fact that they're talking about selflessness in both cases of the person and of phenomena suggests that what they mean by this term self is different. And this is the cause of very, very much confusion and misunderstanding in Western interpretations of Buddhism, where, you know, when we hear this teaching of no self or not self in Buddhism, it's very, very, very easy to misinterpret that to mean get rid of my personality, get rid of my, you know, ego in the sense of the construction of you know, a functional, you know, ego way function. Of understanding myself in the world and all this other stuff, and get rid of my you know, personal desires, et cetera, all this stuff. None of that is what's actually being claimed. All of that stuff does kind of change or is affected in interesting ways by the insight that they're pointing towards, but it's not, that's not the object of negation, to use a sort of term of jargon. Like, that's not what you're trying to get, well, you're not really trying to get rid of anything that's there, but that's, you're certainly not trying to get rid of that. All of your sort of personality and things like that. What you're trying to see through is the misimpression that amid all of that, there is some independently existing essential essence thing that is that self, which is the same is true of phenomena. So you know, people can have people are sort of imagined to have essences. Those would be selves. Phenomena are imagined to have essences. So you could talk about the self, the selflessness of phenomena. In both cases, you're talking about emptiness, the emptiness of people and the emptiness of phenomena. And no self or not self is just that claim about persons that they're empty of inherent or independent existence. And maybe one helpful thing to do here would be to, okay, if somebody's like sort of suspicious of this claim that like we feel that way, you know, like I think most people conceptually will know that, you know, there's no essence to things, or like, you know, if you put it a certain way, that will seem unproblematic to them conceptually. But that doesn't quite get at how deep this intuition runs in people that we do have an independent existence, or that much of our thinking and conceptualization and ways of relating to our experience is sort of about shoring up the sense that there is such an essence. Does that seem like a productive direction to go for you, or do you have another question?
I mean, I always have a ton, but I do like that. And I want to prelude that by saying that I had a very strong experience recently. I had an itch on the side of my face, on my cheek. And it's easy to think in those essentialist terms where it's like, okay, I have an itch on my cheek. Like, I have a cheek, and that's like the essential thing. And then there's a temporary itch that's imposing itself on this essence. But I realized that, no, that fluctuating flux of experience that I call an itch on my cheek right now is what I call my cheek. It is that kind of a flux. And it was just it really cemented this for me recently, which I thought was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So that's a good example, right? So on the other side of this, you know, insight into emptiness that we've been talking about, I don't think it's the case that you would no longer be able to say, I have an itch on my cheek. That would be the sort of nihilistic thing of like, you lose the ability to conceptualize or something like that. Yeah. What you would no longer do is in conceptualizing, I have an itch on my cheek, there's a kind of reification or believing of that, or sense of being sort of sense of that, the givenness of that, of you being subject to that as a sort of immutable fact of experience. All of that would start to sort of drain away, along with a sense of some substantiality of it, and then in that like loss of substantiality, there would be many more degrees of freedom in your way of relating to it. You wouldn't have to react to it in particular ways. You wouldn't have to all the way down to, you know, it may no longer quite seem like an itch, but that's not necessarily important that you lose the sense of it being an itch. But mm-hmm. on the other side of having seen, okay, let me sort of walk through a step. So you start as a normal person who doesn't have any kind of meditation practice. You have a strong itch on your cheek. It's really unpleasant. You've got to scratch it. You can't sit still, etc. Okay. Then you learn to meditate and you start working with this sort of emptiness practice. You could say, I'm abbreviating a lot, but you do that. And eventually you have enough experiences where you notice all the sort of subtle ways of looking at this thing change every single aspect of it, such that when you try to find something in itself that is that itch, you can't find it. You notice that if I'm a little bit aversive, it appears this way. It, you know, the size of it changes depending on my way of looking. The intensity of it changes depending on the way of looking. Whether it's unpleasant changes depending on the way of looking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the way down, even to the point of whether it appears at all, whether that perception is getting fabricated, that also depends on a certain way of looking. If you do that enough, then when it appears on the other side of those insights, you will not, there's a kind of, reflexive attribution of permanence and solidity and independent existence to it that you will no longer habitually do quite as strongly. And in that, it will appear, it may even appear as an itch on your cheek, but there's a kind of substantiality that you were attributing to it before you did all those practices that you won't on the other end of it. And in the no longer attributing that to it, the suffering gets drained out. That's the claim, right? Part of why that's the case is, okay, so in a Buddhist context, suffering has to do with this, has to do with a kind of reactivity where things appear and then we find ourselves in a stance of either aversion or clinging to them. And a sort of pattern of reactivity with them, and that's generative of suffering. But if something no longer has that kind of solid essence separate from you or any sort of separate independent given characteristics, then that whole, you know, gesture essentially of entering into a sense of reactivity with it can't get started in the same way. It's almost like it never comes into independent existence from the awareness that you are in the limit. And then like the idea of taking up a stance toward it or especially an adversarial stance toward it doesn't even make sense. Now we're getting very Buddhist, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I like it. But how does that not end up just negating any discernment and making any choice, quote unquote, meaningless? Or yeah, how do we not slip into the nihilism here?
I will say as like a general caution, this will be misunderstood almost certainly without undertaking it as practice. That's not like a knock on, you know, the intellect of your audience or something like that. It's just like This is meant to point to certain things that don't really make sense outside the context of practice, but much harder to make sense of outside that context. But okay, why is that not nihilism? Okay, so
and lack of
one interpretation of what it would mean for it to be nihilistic is that it doesn't appear, and as I said, the itch can even appear as an itch on your face. And be known to be empty or be understood to be empty in some sense. So it's not that it no longer appears. It's not that it no longer appears with the kind of conceptual differentiation that you need to have to know how to sort of orient toward it properly. What it no longer appears as is an itch on your face as something with solid, reified, permanent independent existence. And that additional sense, that additional reification, is as much a kind of affective, which is to say like emotional Like feeling based stance or response as it is a kind of cognitive one. So it like at the deepest level, like this, like taking things to have independent existence is not, it's not even a thing you think. It's like a clenching around experience to some extent, you know, it's a kind of like, it's an affective response. And that actually contributes to the way you build up the concept at the end. So you one of the things you sort of can come to see in meditation is the way that your sense of the conceptual boundaries between things, or the duality of things, to use another sort of Buddhist jargon, has to do with like the reason why there's a boundary between X and Y, or the a duality between X and Y, has to do with how you respond emotionally to things on either side of that, like X is good, Y is bad, or something like that. And so I know the difference between X and Y, not because it's self-standing in the world that way, but because I react one way to one half of it and the other way to another half. And you sort of build up your concepts by your reactivity. And it's that, it's the fact that you're doing that becomes clear, not the ability to navigate by doing that in some sense. So in knowing that you're doing that, in knowing that in some sense you're participating in the construction of your conceptualization of the world, then degrees of freedom open up to do that differently, more skillfully, etc. Not this sort of like, therefore you shouldn't do it at all. Does that start to make sense?
Yeah, and I guess this also ties into the differences in certain traditions and the difference in view that we've talked about before, where, where certain people would say that the insight, a deep insight into emptiness, would be kind of the end stage. And then, it doesn't really matter what you do. You can just sit and bliss out in that. But you can also take the position that, okay, I've realized emptiness, and I can see that this polar bear charging against my naked body right now on Antarctica. I don't even know if Antarctica has polar bears or if it's exclusive to North Pole or something. But you still have to make a choice. Do I want to move from this empty thing that's going to bite my head off right now? So
emptiness is not non-existence, right? So it's not about that. Yeah. Like, there's this constant move to say, you know, if I knew that the polar bear was empty, therefore I wouldn't even know a polar bear was there. Therefore I wouldn't get out of the way. And it just doesn't follow at all.
That's the takeaway I want for all the listeners. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, but you see, like it's weird how reflexively that sort of misimpression gets generated if I knew the polar bear was empty, then why wouldn't I just get eaten? It just doesn't follow, you know. The polar bear never wasn't empty. So whatever, you know. In the sense that this is just a general misimpression we have about phenomena. There's nothing it had that you're depriving it of. There's nothing you're trying to get rid of. There's no distinction that you're currently making that you're trying to deprive yourself of the ability to make. There's none of that. There's a global misconception in some sense about how ontology works, you could say. And ontology in this case sort of goes all the way down to the level of feelings. But that global misconception is that things are independently existing, not dependently arisen.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken about this a lot privately, but I mean, I have, I've had a lot of quote unquote fear of emptiness in my own practice and in my journey here, where coming from a lot of disassociation and big T trauma, things like that, I have a very easy way of slipping into that trauma as I see it, and dissociation is kind of can be a very strong contraction and additional reification on this sense of being a separate unit, and that you get a very strong sense that you need to separate yourself even further, and you need to really contract to protect yourself, and you have to kind of, it becomes an attempt to shut everything out and an attempt to be able to control it. But yeah. That's also what's creating the problem, because what you wanted in the first place was to feel safe and non-separate from everything and be connected to people. I mean, my strongest thing that I've been working with is this severe sense of feeling disconnected. And so it's a bad bind to be in. And so I can notice that a lot now when I like Joe Hudson's corkscrew view of development, where you... it's not linear. It's not like, oh, I figured out this one thing and now I'm never going to end up there again. It's more a matter of, okay, I go back on the corkscrew. So I used to have daddy issues, and then I thought I got past that, but now I'm back to being really mad at my dad after Christmas. But it's higher up on the corkscrew, and thus it's a little lighter. It's a little less reified. It's a little easier to get out of the story. Yeah. And that's something that keeps going. And so I'm oscillating in and out a lot, but I'm noticing that it can come up a lot when I notice emptiness and when I have a strong insight into this that can be extremely liberating. It can also oscillate into the unconscious terror that comes up of the, you know, I'm going crazy. I can't let these defenses go. I need to reify even harder, and I get more disassociated, and it's like this JoJo effect. And so for me, it's extremely useful to conceptually pry at these, try to unscrew it conceptually in a way where experientially I feel more safe to do it. So I'm selfishly doing that, and I'm hoping that it might be able to help anyone else who, I'm sure I'm not alone in that type of experience.
No, that's super, super, super important and really, really well put. There are a couple things that come up for me in reacting to it, but we should have said probably at the outset, this word emptiness sucks. it's a terrible word for what's being referred to here, and doesn't help at all in averting some of these misconceptions about it. It's a translated word, you know, from this word shunyata, and I don't know what connotations the word shunyata has. But emptiness in terms of its connotations for us is fucking terrible.
Precisely
because, as you say, it seems to suggest this kind of nihilism or depersonalization or derealization and all this stuff, which it certainly is not. It'd probably be useful to say, you said this well, but just unpack a little bit why it isn't that, and what the difference is between what you're describing as contributing to the sense of separation from the world or the world. Okay, so like if I say, for example, like the world gets drained of this sense of substantiality and independent existence, it's very difficult in the absence of actually having that experience to know what the difference is between that and the sort of depersonalization, derealization experience of
nightmare.
I'm not a person, I'm the ghost, and the world is just a kind of meaningless dead appearances that are just sort of like, you know, that have no invitation for me, this kind of like nihilistic, like I don't belong in the world kind of thing, right? It's very difficult just at the level of like, you know, the terms we're using to describe the difference between those two things. One helpful way of unpacking practically what would lead to one and what would lead to the other is this separation point that you were making. So what leads to that sense of depersonalization, derealization is this kind of posture of closing oneself off from the world more and more and more in order to try to, it's a kind of like self-protective move. And you'll know more about the phenomenology of this than me, but to correct me if I'm wrong here, like it's this kind of like, well, as you say, it can be like a trauma response, but it's this kind of, the world is becoming too threatening. And so the move in response to that is to try to get more and more and more distance from it in order to make it less threatening and less ability, give it less ability to harm me. And then the more distance you get, the more dead the world appears, because it's like, I'm trying to push myself further and further and further away from this thing to make it no longer harmful. And as you say, it can get into a sort of reciprocal loop where that hurts, that sort of like posture of separation hurts, which you then attribute to the world, the pain, and then which gets you more and more in this posture of of self-protection and separation. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can add an extra element of horror to that if the if one of the original facilitating events to that depersonalization response is a fear of your own mind, essentially. Fear of going crazy or something like that, where the loop not only becomes trying to withdraw from the world, but also constantly prying into your own mind, searching for dangerous things. So it becomes like a double problem in those instances, which I'm sure is common too.
That sounded
very, very accurate for sure.
No, but it's a very good point that it's not. I was saying the world. It's not really just the world. It's also the contents of your own mind that you can stand in that depersonalized or derealized relationship to. That's a good point. And I should just say, we should say, to whomever's still listening at this point, if that is what's happening to you when you meditate, stop meditating. don't do that. That's not the point. That's not what the effect it's trying to have. If you're just like pushing really hard on it and you're getting more and more sort of nihilistic and derealized and stuff like that, stop. Mm-hmm. There's no moral need to meditate and do that to yourself, and that's not the goal. And people really, really screw themselves up with that. So why is that different than what we're talking about?
Yeah.
So it starts with that initial posture of reactivity toward the thing that seems to be threatening. And so if the difference in response between what would lead to this insight into emptiness and what would lead to derealization is this separation and closing oneself off from the phenomenon versus this opening to and not separating oneself from the phenomenon. So it's like, some painful emotion comes up. Do you try to numb yourself to that emotion by getting more and more distance from it and pushing it further and further and further away until, maybe you're no longer feeling it in quite the same way, but at the cost of your sense of being alive? Or do you open to, get intimate with, become closer to, incorporate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that emotion? And that's a very different experience. If you do that, it's not, it might in fact get stronger, especially in the beginning. But what I think you can attest to this, having done so much sort of somatic practice, that it's not that that becomes so massive and threatening and painful that it's, overwhelming and terrible if you do that. It can sort of like work its way through and energetically. And, in the limit, that's not really even what emptiness is about. Emptiness is even sort of more fundamental than that, where it's like it doesn't have to sort of work its way through. It just sort of is liberated in the instance of it's being seen that way. But it's a very different stance that one is it's almost the opposite stance that one is taking up toward the appearance that would produce those different responses.
Shit, man. I love this. I think it's super interesting. But so it could be fun to point a little more towards, with your caveat in mind that you're not an enlightened, I was going to say Jedi master, but that's not right. but you're still on the path, and both you and I have probably had a lot more direct experience of emptiness in practice than most people listening. So how would you feel about talking a little bit about our own experience on being on this path and maybe pointing to how it can be described in terms of a sitting practice?
Yeah. Well, okay, so one misconception to kind of flag at the outset is that like in some traditions and for some practice goals, there's a kind of direct cognition of emptiness is what how it often gets put, or so like insight into emptiness with a capital I and a capital E, that is like a it's a sort of specific experience that then people who hear us to talking about emptiness might say, oh, I haven't had that big insight into emptiness or direct cognition of emptiness, therefore I have no idea what you're talking about. And I would just say you know, bracketing what that experience is and whether it exists and stuff. I think that's a real thing. You don't have to have had that experience to know what we're talking about, or even to have an experience of emptiness in a certain sense. Emptiness is sort of everywhere to be found in your experience if you pay attention. To go to the point about countries, that is in fact emptiness. I mean, that's just a very the fact that the borders between countries are not independently existing in the world is an instance of emptiness, you know, like the genuine article in some sense. It's not, you know, an especially liberating one. Exactly. But that's the real thing. I would urge people not to sort of like put emptiness in some Neverland fairyland of, you know, one day I will have a direct insight into emptiness and be free.
Yeah.
Like, it's much more about like, it's everywhere to be found in every moment of experience, if you look. So that's, that's one caveat. But, okay. In terms of practice. Yeah. I just want to like super flag that this is not something with which I'm super familiar, and Charlie would, for example, be a great person to bring on to talk about this in much more depth from a practice point of view. Okay, so one practice, for example, that I'm doing a lot now is this emptiness of the personality, or emptiness of self, depending on how you want to put it, meditation. And the practice goes something like this. So you sort of develop a certain amount of what's called shamatha, or sort of concentration and tranquility and calm, to just sort of get your mind settled in a pliable condition. And then you deliberately bring up the sense of the sort of personality or self, or like my sense of meanness, like the Jake-ness that I walk around with all the time. And that can be a little bit abstract for people, but you'd be surprised if you kind of do this of like, okay, say I'm sitting alone in my apartment and somebody shows up, something comes online there of a kind of, now I have to be a person, you know, like me. That's the thing that's being referred to, this sort of diffuse sense of, Jake-ness in my case. And so you sort of let that come up, not super reflectively, you know, so you're not yet looking for what it is, but you kind of become aware of that sensation as what's called the object of negation. So like, become familiar with this thing that you're about to undertake a search for, so that you know what it is that you're trying to negate. And what it is that you're trying to negate is the sense that that appearance, whatever comes up when you bring up your sense of personality, doesn't have independent, and that it's very important to add that, doesn't have independent existence. So I'm not trying to get rid of the sensations. What I'm trying to do is, okay, when those sensations come up, there's this kind of pre-reflective sense of it's got an independent substantiality to it. And that's me. That's what I am. And then once you've sort of become familiar with those sensations, then you undertake a search with awareness. You're sort of bringing awareness to different locations in your body or whatever else, to thoughts, etc., to see if you can find, and you have to really do this in earnest, like maybe you might find it, but see if you can find anything in itself, any sensation, any appearance that is that personality, that self. And if you do that, you know, you search through your feet, you won't find it. You search through your chest, your torso, you won't find it. Search through your head, which often seems like where it is, you won't find it. You won't find anything. And it's not that it stops appearing in that case, but the more you do that search, and the more you keep sort of landing on nothing, like not finding anything in particular, or if you think you found it, so like, oh, I found it, it's right here, you know, in the back of my throat, sort of in the bottom part of my head, that's where it is, I know it is, look more carefully there. The awareness kind of won't be able to land on a thing, and it's almost like awareness.
Go ahead. Just to clarify there, you said it there, that it keeps appearing, but what you're not finding is one essential, solid, carried through from moment to moment thing that you can attribute and call yourself. Like, it's not, because what was that?
It's actually even more intense than that. So it's awareness doesn't actually even find something that it can land on that isn't just the awareness. Because there's something about this gesture of looking with awareness for an essence that just is bound to fail, because nothing has an essence apart from awareness in a strange sense. And so when you undertake this search with awareness for the sensation, for the essence of a sensation, for example, what you find is that awareness just kind of can't land on something, which you could think of as like awareness finding that sensation has the essence of awareness. And then the sense of it being a separate appearance from awareness can recede. Okay, so.
But what does it mean to because this is something that I, like, for instance, I have a strong sense often in my more reified moments that I think it is a vague image of my face or something like that, that yep. has this attribute of being a candidate for being being me, I guess.
Yeah. It's funny when you put it, when you have to state it directly, right? Like, yeah, that's what I really am. I'm this image of my face that's appearing right now.
Of course. Yeah. But so you're saying in the search for me, let's say I were to, are you saying that if I were to investigate that image properly, I would see that that's insubstantial, it would go away, it's just a modification of awareness?
Okay, so there are multiple ways you might, there are different kinds of emptiness meditation, right? So you might just say, as a matter of like conceptual reasoning, which is a valid way of approaching this to some extent, like, okay, am I really this image of my face? You know, and start to get a sense of the silliness of it. And if you really sort of believe the conceptual reasoning, that can actually have a sort of, you know, profound effect. Like, you know, you're not the attention behind your eyes. You're not the, you know, et cetera. Like, did you really think you were the attention behind your eyes, et cetera, that kind of thing. So that's one way of undertaking it. For the specific way of undertaking it that I'm talking about, this insight into the kind of unfindability of it isn't so much like, yes, it has the meaning of that appearance doesn't have independent existence, but what it feels... Okay, so maybe one helpful way of putting this is to talk about this from the other end of Rigpa and this sort of what's the nature of mind in which everything is seen as empty and yet appearing as a sort of union of appearance of emptiness. Now we're really getting into the weeds, but we're an hour and 15 minutes in. If we've lost some people... this is something I want to talk about with you specifically, so our audience can just deal. okay, so take this from the other end and say, what's the sort of insight into the nature of mind that this practice of emptiness is in some sense helping to facilitate or reveal? Mm-hmm. In that condition of Rigpa, right, everything is being spontaneously known to be empty and yet appearing, and those two attributes of awareness of experience are inseparable. Empty yet appearing, empty yet appearing. And there's no sense of reified subject-object duality of there's a thing in awareness that's me, and then there's the thing that's the object, and I'm separate from that object in a solid, permanent sense. Okay. So, yep. Okay. That's part of what Rigpa is like. I'm not going to say that's the whole show. But, okay. okay. Now, starting from my condition of, you know, deludedness, here I am searching with my awareness for certain appearances, right? If you think about that, that search is being undertaken on the basis of a kind of delusion, which is that, like, I'm over here, the awareness, looking for something that's other than the awareness to land on that is the thing. That isn't the awareness, mm-hmm. right? The sensation, the image, the thought, etc. If you do that, if you take the awareness, so to speak, and look, so to speak, for the thing that is other than the awareness, and try to find it with the awareness, that not finding, the failure to do that, is just like awareness landing on yet more awareness, and then the idea that there's something apart from awareness. Starts to recede. That kind of makes sense. It's weird how this is something that I didn't understand at all in the conceptual description of the practice, but that when I did it, I was like, oh fuck, that's what's happening. You know, like it's like I mean by like it doesn't really make sense conceptually. Like it makes conceptually of like nothing has inherent existence, blah blah blah. But this idea that it relates to Rigpa, for example, or like why the unfindability would be significant. That wasn't obvious to me at all until I practiced it. So that makes sense. So like you're in some sense, everything is about unconfusing awareness that there's something self-standing and independently existing in awareness
right.
that isn't.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I should say just to be for the Buddhist nitpickers in the audience, or not nitpickers, because it's an important point, but the awareness itself also doesn't have inherent existence. And that's sort of like the final frontier. Yeah.
Right. No, I mean, I would this be what's called, is this a type of vipassana? Because I mean, what I practice right now in Vast Sky Mind is a combination of shamatha, usually the without an object, the dropping the ball, just which I equate basically with the shine from Dzogchen, the open awareness, remain uninvolved. So finding
shine is just the Tibetan word for shamatha. But the way shine gets used in the Arrow Terror, what's called the Four Knowledge Orders, which is what you're referring to, just refers to an objectless shamatha, because it's got the sort of twin goals of a shamatha practice, which is to take you to tranquility and stability, and the goal of a sort of vipassana practice, which is to take you to emptiness. And so the first of the Four Knowledge Orders, shine there, is objectless and has remained uninvolved as an instruction, both because it's a kind of stability practice, which is to say a shamatha practice, and it'll get you to emptiness because you're not engaging with conceptuality. Anyway, that's confusing. Yeah. But shine and shamatha are actually the same. It's just the Tibetan and Sanskrit.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's nice. But so that's a practice I like very much, and I'm kind of more averse oftentimes to doing the more structured vipassana, Mahamudra style, going through different parts of your experience where you might be extra chunky in terms of reification. So I'm doing that and I enjoy that a lot, but I'm still noticing it goes so well with my somatic practice. And I really think, I don't know if that's the case because I'm so extra reified in terms of my body, my physical tension, and the sense of meanness behind the head because of my issues. And now I notice the contrast so much. So it's hard to know how other quote unquote normal people feel, but I'm feeling more and more now a very cool sense of being transparent, I guess you could say, or like not in the horrifying way of being a ghost separate from everything, but I don't know. I feel much less dense. I feel like, empty is a good word here, actually. And I can also see myself, you used the example of how you would sense the jakiness springing into existence when someone comes along. I can, on some days when I'm on the right side of the corkscrew, as it were, I can really walk around and feel like I'm not thinking much at all. There's not that much conceptualizing going on. And then in terms of explicit images and thoughts that I don't recognize as thoughts. But then as soon as I see a person, I start selfing. I can see the intermittently continuing pattern that I call Christopher spring into action, almost like, okay, now I have to, like it's useful to have this personality function go into action now. But that doesn't have to linger as some kind of essence when I'm not doing that, when there's no need to use it. And then I can also notice very strongly when I interact, oftentimes at home with my wife, because that's where I spend most of my time. But she, I can see how I come across, how I express myself is not something that it's easy to think of yourself like this. I am this kind of person in every circumstance. And it's so easy for me to see now that I spring into action depending on what she does. Like something as easy as making a certain face, it was completely dependently coerced with whatever it was that she was saying at that particular point. And you can very strongly sense the dance and experience the dance and the co-creation of interacting both with the world and with other people around you. I think it's really cool type of flowy type experience that when I'm not resisting it is very, very freeing And it, yeah, it's just like being in flow in a way where there's no friction. It's really cool.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that description. I guess this is actually a helpful way of pointing at why emptiness is not non-appearance, or why it's not, you know, getting rid of something. It's like, you know, you were talking about how the personality can kind of come online, and there can be a sort of fear there if you're doing a lot of practice, like, oh, if this comes back online, then I'll lose my wonderful state of emptiness or something like that. It's like, no, that's not the case. So,
or if it goes offline, that you're dying or disappearing,
exactly. Yeah. No, exactly. But so it comes online, and then the question is not like, do you say, oh no, that's bad, I lost my emptiness. The question is, when it comes back online, is there this kind of subtle primordial confusion that it's taking on an independent existence that happens, and it isn't. And so that, you know, one way you might see that is, you know, in the emptiness practice that I just described, you're literally bringing it online on purpose so that you can search for it, not to get rid of it, but to unconfuse. I like this language for me. It's just helpful. Like unconfusing awareness that appearance is coming into independent existence. It's a very strange. Yeah. Now nobody's gonna know what the fuck we're talking about, man. But
I'm no, I like it. The reason I resonate so much with, for example, someone like Sam Harris, over someone like, say, Eckhart Tolle, even though some of what they teach overlap, and that was kind of the progression I went through, actually. So I was a strong Eckhart Tolle fan first, but I just love the idea that, okay, we can make these claims about subjective conscious experience, and we can leave the metaphysics aside. So this has no implication for whether science is worthwhile or I know nothing about fusion in stars or whatever. I think that's David Deutsch's example. By my conscious experience, like, theory can actually, explanatory power is extremely impressive, and the fact that we can talk about these things right now and portray, hopefully, to some people something that can facilitate an experience, which is what we're talking about, is immensely powerful and super cool. It's just, I love the combination of using it for what it's useful for, just like springing into the strong personality can be really useful in interaction with people and necessary to live a functional life. You don't have to fucking go around and reify yourself as this thing, this person, all the time when you're sitting by yourself on the toilet or whatever. Like, you don't need that function to shit or to eat or whatever. And it's unnecessary strain. And the same thing with the conceptuality, like, in general, it's super useful when we want to make our next scientific breakthrough or analyze something. That's great. We need thought. We need to use that, and we can use it then, but we can still have the proper relationship to it and see that it is thought and know what relationship it has to the world, and that it isn't scripture going on in our heads, or that we are the voice and everything that's being said in our heads. So it's just cool to have both sides of it, which is why I love someone like Sam Harris or someone like yourself, or Michael Taft is also very good in that respect, I think. But so on that point, I just want to stress again that just because this is something that I recently got in one of our text exchanges, which is I didn't understand what it meant to say that there's no separation, there's no duality between anything in your experience. I kind of thought that meant that I am just as much my wife as I am myself. And that made me upset, because in one way that is ludicrous, but in another sense it makes sense. It makes sense in the sense that we've been describing, that the experience of whatever I call my wife, whatever she is objectively in the world as an existing, presumably physical being, my whatever I experience of her is not separate from my awareness. Everything in my experience is equally much my awareness. Yeah. But
and even just to be really annoying about it, the part of the reason this confusion shows up is that there's this temptation to say my awareness, right? Or like, and again, I'm not making metaphysical, but like, at the level that we're talking about, the awareness is no more yours than anybody. Like mine, like self and other, mine and not mine, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is conceptual differentiation within a prior condition that doesn't have that conceptual differentiation, which is not to say that that conceptual differentiation is not allowed or something.
No.
But that, yeah. So it's like, you know, my wife is just as much me as I am, because she's here. She is appearing in my awareness is the kind of mistake of the mind only thing that we're talking about before. Of it's my awareness, so you're just part of my awareness. It's like, no, this is awareness is not yours either.
No, exactly. So, but that was just that was such an aha moment for me. I know I wrote that to you, but when I realized that, oh fuck, I can relax, that contradiction is solved, so I can relax and feel like I'm not separate from my wife, and that awareness is unified as a field in that sense. But I can still rest in the fact that I'm still a physical being. I'm not the entire universe, basically, which is one of the tropes that I fucking hate. That I guess some people love to feel like that. But I really that's always disturbed me when people say that you are the whole universe, just because I'm not strictly separate from it in any ultimate sense. That doesn't mean I have access to most of the infinite universe.
Yeah. There's a habit in when these things get taught that's not just to be annoying. Of whenever somebody emphasizes the sort of monism or eternalism side of it, the teacher will then be like, "But actually, the dualism, you know, like in other words, like because it's such a fine line, the sort of middle way between nihilism and eternalism and monism and dualism." Generally speaking, whenever the student says, "Oh, I finally discovered," like it's I'm not as separate as I thought I was, then the response is usually like, "But you are in X, Y, and Z ways," and then vice versa. It's like, "Oh, I'm so separate," you know, I've realized I'm so different, but it's like, "But actually, are you really different?" You know, it's like not to say that there's no place to land exactly there, although there kind of isn't. It's a very fine line to not make the mistake in one direction or the other, and it's very easy to tip in one way or the other. There was something I was going to say. So in that spirit, because you're like, you know, these are all claims about experience, and like, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with any kind of scientific claims. Yes, I agree with you in a certain sense, but just to be annoying, I'll make this other thing, which is I'll make this other claim, which is it's very easy when somebody emphasizes that from the outset, like we're just making a kind of interesting, quirky psychological claim about your mind or whatever, you know, like this is a cool, neat trick that you can do that doesn't really have any bearing on, you know, your deep conceptions of reality. It's very easy to then not realize how deep this runs, which is like all the way to your conceptions of time and space and self and world. And nothing is nothing isn't included at the level of, you know, how you're conceiving of things. And yes, that's not to say that, like, you know, the guy who has the deepest insight into emptiness knows anything about quantum physics or something like that. That's not what we're saying. But it, on some level, it runs that deep, which is to say, like your conception of what you are in the world can totally change on the basis of this kind of inquiry, rather than it staying at some kind of just like surface level of like a kind of psychological nicety. So anyway, I'm just to balance it out.
I take that point, and I also wonder what, because what we're doing here is we're deconstructing that conceptual hierarchy, conceptual perceptual hierarchy. If you go back to that Shamil's model, and we can reach this point where we're very de-reified, deconstructed I feel like that. Then you get.
It's not that. That's an instrumental practice. This sort of like deconstruction into quote unquote raw sensations. That is a tactic, not a truth. So like, if you were to then go, the raw sensations are the thing, not the concept, that would be to misunderstand emptiness.
Yeah, no, my point with that was like to start deconstructing and see how perception constructs and reifies the sense of separateness and objectness and all these things. It gives you insight into, it gives you deep insight in one sense, but in another sense, it doesn't tell you much at all about, let's say, normativity, for instance. You there's many different paths you can take. You still have to create, for instance, moral theories and knowledge about what the fuck do I do with this?
Yeah, they're not orthogonal. I mean, the connection to ethics is very tricky, and it's not perfect for sure. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like you could be enlightened, it'd be hard to be an asshole, but you can have such a wrong. Or sort of just culturally out of place or whatever else view of things, or underdeveloped from a sort of developmental psychological point of view, moral outlook that you behave in harmful ways. So yeah, it's not the connection. It's not as though, you know, moral behavior scales linearly with insight into this thing. It's not unconnected to morality either, in the sense that like a great deal of love gets unbound.
Yeah, absolutely. And the non-separateness.
In having these kinds of insights and all the things that would lead one to sort of intend ill of others can also sort of get disentangled in this process. So it's not absolutely totally orthogonal to morality, but it's not the whole picture either. And then with respect to your question about physics, for example, yes, that there's no theory of physics that falls out of these kinds of insights at all. But the reason why I say it runs really, really deep is that in terms of its import on your life, it almost matters. Like I'm going to make a claim here. You can tell me if this is not true. Mm-hmm. Which interpretation of quantum mechanics is true has absolutely no impact on how you live personally. It might have impact on how some people live, but I would say it has virtually no impact on how you live. But your deep preconceptual earliest intuitive conceptions of time and space and world and self, right? Which are not, which are contributing to, but are not constitutive of the sort of, quantum theory interpretation, right? That does have a huge impact on how you live, whether or not you realize it, and how you feel moment to moment and all this other stuff. And so on some level, yes, it doesn't give you any insight into the physics of things exactly, but the insight it does give you into things that seem like in the physics territory, like the sort of first person preconceptual sense of time and space and world, run much deeper for how you live, I would say.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely.
All right, man. Physical tiredness is taking me over right now, so even though I would love to continue for 4 more hours, I think I'll have to check out here for today. But we weaved in some of the Twitter questions there. Maybe we can circle back and see if we want to do a second episode here. We can touch on the ones we missed and dive even deeper. So thanks a lot for coming on, man. It's always a pleasure.
All right, brother, thanks so much for having me.